This is Speaking of Faith's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Alan Dienstag. He is a clinical psychologist who's led support groups with early Alzheimer's patients, as well as a writing group which he co-designed with the novelist Don DeLillo. I spoke with him on March 4th, 2009, from the studios of American Public Media in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was in a private recording studio in New York City. This interview is included in our program, Alzheimer's, Memory, and Being. Download the MP3 of the produced show at speakingoffaith.org. Do you have any questions for me before we start?
In talking with... Okay, now I'm going to start fussing. So can I be a little less loud
yes,
to myself? Okay,
because I
feel like
right
I'm...
now, Chris, I'm going in okay.
Adjusting. All right.
I'm sorry. Sorry about
no,
that.
No, don't be sorry. Yeah, we have to get this perfect.
Yeah. I feel like I'm actually having a real conversation, but I'm getting too much of myself. So you know how that is.
Yeah, I do.
I guess, one question that I have is that, Rob gave me the sense that you all were, struggling was too strong a word, but, you were wrestling a little bit with, how to approach the subject. And, I'm curious about that. And I'm curious about where you arrived or if you arrived or... and how this fits into that, just maybe a little bit of the larger context,
It's just, I think that it's a subject we've been talking about for a while. And I don't know if you are aware of this, but I had a pretty formative experience when I was studying theology of working as a chaplain on the Alzheimer's floor of a home and hospital for the elderly.
Oh, no.
And I've written a little bit about that, and it's... it was actually very important to me. We put out a query, which I think you saw. Didn't you respond to it? And, got a variety of responses. It's just that... and then we did a couple of interviews several years ago that just weren't... It wasn't quite right. So I think we just... Mm-hmm. Now, having said that... I've spent this last couple of days steeped in things you've written and revisiting some of the literature I'm aware of, but also really getting a good sense, I think, of how you've come at this. And so, I mean, I'm not confused right now about this conversation. I'm really looking forward to it. I think that what you speak to that is what we want to get at is... this idea that much more attention has been paid to that a lot of attention has been paid to the physical and maybe even spiritual health of caregivers, understandably, and that there hasn't been so much reflection on the psychological and relational aspects of people with Alzheimer's disease. And I feel like that's something you do know about. And so that's kind of how I want to shine a light on this, if we can. And I will bring in some of my experiences, some of the experiences that I had, because this is something I still, would love to talk about. It's not ever finished with it or made complete sense of it.
So, I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that, actually. I mean, I'm glad my fellow traveler in that way.
I think one thing that's different about this is most of the subjects we take on, even if it's something like depression, we had our program on depression on last week, you can talk to people, you talk to somebody who's had the experience. And Alzheimer's is different. I mean, yes, of course, I could interview someone in the early stages, but that wouldn't really tell the whole story. And you know what I'm also interested in, and I do sense that you've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I certainly want to get to this with you, is how do these experiences you have make you, shape your thinking about what it means to be human or how you live with some of these issues of how our memory forms us or death. So that's where I want to go, and I think we should just plunge in. From reading what I've read of you, I sense that you're ready to have that conversation too. So, Mitch, I'm getting a... Yeah? Right. Okay. So we will go 60 to 90 minutes. I understand that we have to stop right at three, my time 4 years. So let's get going. I would like to hear just a little bit. This is a question I ask everybody, whatever we're talking about, just a little bit about the religious. Was there a religious or spiritual background to your life? I read that your father was a cantor.
Yeah. My father was a cantor. He's retired now, and I grew up with a very large suburban synagogue family.
Right.
as the son of the cantor, and I had a religious education. So I'm. That's very much a part of my life, and it's absolutely a lens through which I see these things, and of course memory is a big part of my tradition, the Jewish tradition. So it's very much all around in that respect.
And what interested you about psychology? How did that happen?
You know, that's one of those questions that I wish I had a great answer to. You know, it's very hard. It's very hard to say. I mean, I really just gravitated in that direction. It was the thing that I was most curious about. You know, it's funny because people ask a similar kind of question about, well, why would you want to work with old people?
Right.
And of course, it kind of reflects a certain bias in our culture because it's very hard for us to understand that there might be anything interesting about older people. That's the kind of the prevailing attitude. In my early life, I was taken care of by my grandparents. I had two grandmothers who were my babysitters,
right.
And so people in my family and people who know me are certain that this is how I ended up doing this kind of work. I'm a little less certain of that, but I'm willing to kind of entertain that idea.
And how did you then get into working specifically with people with Alzheimer's disease?
Well, I knew when I got into graduate school that I wanted to work with older adults. I absolutely knew that, and so I kind of gravitated in that direction. I moved in that direction, and when I got out of school, there weren't kind of working opportunities for me to do that I was happy with. So I volunteered to run a caregiver support group for the Alzheimer's Association.
Okay.
And this is about 20 years ago. That group was my education. I learned more about the illness and the experience of having Alzheimer's disease and the caregiving experience from that group than any formal education that I had. And so once I started doing that, that kind of set me off on the track to work with people with Alzheimer's disease. And from there, I started a group, a support group for people in the early stages of the illness themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That was not going on in the area where I was working. It was happening, I later found out, in other parts of the country. There were pockets of this taking place. But at that time, it was still not a common kind of intervention. It's become a little bit more common. There were many caregiver support groups, but not a lot of groups for people in the early stages of the illness.
What was the reasoning behind that, or the sensibility that led things in that direction?
That
caregivers were cared for, but so much attention wasn't paid to the people actually. Well, I mean, the caregivers are suffering too. You can't just say those are the only people suffering.
Absolutely.
But the Alzheimer's patients themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think there are a couple of things. You know, one is that it coincided with advances in the diagnosis of the illness, and so as more and more was learned about Alzheimer's and how it was different from other kinds of dementia, there was a kind of an elevating of the profile of the illness itself that kind of took place, right? I mean, you know, there was a period of time where all these dementias were kind of lumped together, and the specificity
right.
and diagnosis and understanding was really not where it is today. I mean, there's really been, you know, tremendous advances in that respect. So when that happens, you know, there's a kind of identity to each subtype that can become somewhat more elaborated, right? And
mm-hmm.
you can reach out to people in particular with the particular diagnosis. So I think that was one factor that made it more common around that period of time. And also, that period of time was a kind of general flourishing of a support group movement in mm-hmm. this country, which, again, you know, we sort of take for granted now, but there was a period of time where that way of helping people, that way for people with particular kinds of difficulties and challenges and problems to self-identify and find one another became much more common. And I think also the medical profession began to take support groups a little bit more seriously as real medicine.
Right, right.
For people with cancer, for people with all kinds of illnesses. So I think all of that started to come together. And then the final thing that I would say is that, you know, our population is aging.
Yeah.
And so all of that,
it's
that's
more
a background.
Older age is more mainstream than it used
yes,
to be.
Yes, that's right. Uh-huh. That's right. Yeah, yeah.
And do you think, was there also a sense that because this was a disease that had an inevitable decline, because there was mm-hmm. no cure and no idea of, and not really even treatment, and no sense of
right.
how it would come about, that patients were treated differently because of that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, yes. I mean, you don't, you know, I think doctors are like everyone else, and, you know, you don't want to be associated with a losing cause.
Yeah.
Right?
Right,
I mean, it
right.
sounds harsh to say that, but I think that it's just a human, you know, it's just a human quality that we want to turn away from those things. We're a little bit afraid of those things. You want to place your energies where you know that you can have the kind of maximum impact.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you know that what you're going to preside over is a slipping away,
mm-hmm.
A degeneration, I think for a lot of people that's a reason to just stay away from it.
Right.
You know.
And I suppose the idea was that to the extent that these people with this disease might be cared for at that purely human level, that would
mm-hmm.
best be done by the people who knew them best rather
yeah.
than their doctors.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think there's definitely some of that. I think I can't tell you how many times I've interviewed people whose internists upon, you know, so someone will start having trouble with their memory, and the first stop is kind of the family doctor. And, you know, when you're talking about this generation, that may be someone who's known them for 20 or 30 years and may even be the same age, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
Or close, you know. You know, I've often heard these stories of, you know, the doctor saying, well, I you know, I'm forgetting as well. Everybody forgets. Sort of not, and in it you can hear, you know, or I can hear anyway, kind of reading between the lines that, you know, there's a kind of denial there on the part of the doctor that a lack of curiosity at a crucial moment that's being driven by that fear,
mm-hmm.
you know, and not wanting to look, you know, not wanting to see it. So I think that is a factor when we talk about Alzheimer's disease. It is difficult to face, and I think that leads us to act in ways, in particular kinds of ways, or not act in particular kinds of ways. And it's part of the challenge of this illness,
mm-hmm.
you know.
You know, when I spent some time working as a chaplain mm-hmm. to people with Alzheimer's disease, I mean, I brought no training to speak of at all to that, but I came to feel that the great gift I could give these people, mm-hmm. and not through any virtue of my own, but was this, that I had not met them before, that I was encountering them, getting to know them, and coming to care about them mm-hmm. precisely as they were in that moment. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. in the early days, I used to be very impatient and kind of judgmental sometimes with nurses who'd worked with people mm-hmm. a long time, and even with family members who came in, mm-hmm. and I felt like they were so dismissive and they infantilized mm-hmm. these people. But I finally mm-hmm. realized that was wrong of me, because the people who knew them, who'd known them over time, were always grieving the mm-hmm. loss. They were always comparing mm-hmm. them, understandably, to the person they'd known.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what I could give is that I only knew them like this, and I could love them like that.
Yes.
Which was huge.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a great advantage. It's a great advantage. You're not lost in comparing this uh-huh. moment with what was before, and seeing the tragedy of it in that light, right?
I mean,
you may have been in touch with the tragedy of it in other ways, but mm-hmm. but the heaviness of you know, having to look at someone and know how much has been lost mm-hmm. is very hard to bear. It's very mm-hmm. hard to bear, you know.
So
ask a lot of those people. I try to be aware of that also. And, you know, I as someone who was in a similar position to you, when I encounter people, but I work with caregivers as well. And I that's something that strikes me over and over again, that we're asking them to make an enormous adjustment when we ask them to cope with the changes that have taken place, you know, and continue to unravel in front of
them. It's like grief in slow motion. It's like death in slow motion in a way. I know.
Yes.
I came to understand that it was completely unreasonable for me to judge that. So I wonder if when you, if you think about then, because you do work, I mean, I know you work with caregivers, but also with mm-hmm. people with Alzheimer's. So you can't cure them. You can't heal them in any 360-degree way. How do you think about your role? What is the purpose of your work with them as a psychologist? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, this is something that the writing group really changed for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that my answer to that is my role is to is to help them remember, and I really take that as a moment to moment kind of task. In other words, I'm not trying to help them remember their shopping list or their, you know, although I'm willing to talk with them about that, but you know, I'm there to help them experience themselves as remembering people. And now we're talking. Remember, and I think it's important to specify, you know, we're talking about people in the early stages of the illness now who are cognizant of what's happening, you know, who are having real deficits, experiencing real deficits, but who can convey their experience and who can talk about it. And in those instances, that's what I'm doing. I'm also encouraging them in whatever way they are comfortable with to not waste time and to take these opportunities that they have to say what they want to say to the people that they want to say those things to. It really slips away quickly, and you see it slipping away, you know, week after week. And I think part of the value of being diagnosed and going through the trouble to be diagnosed and sort of being identified, which a lot of people resist, by the way.
Right, right, because of,
Yeah, well, because of that sense of hopelessness, right, is precisely that, you know, that you can manage it in some active way, and you can take a look at what lies ahead and think about what you want to do.
You've said that you've written that previously, prior to the writer's group, you realize that if you thought about memory at all in terms of your Alzheimer's patients, you thought about the loss of memory. And the writer Don DeLillo, who it sounds like his mother-in-law was suffering from Alzheimer's, which was his exposure to this, and he opened your mind up about that, didn't he, into a different way? Tell me about that.
Well, you know, I was running this group, the support group, for people in the early stages of Alzheimer's, and I got a call from someone who ran the local chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, and who told me that that there was someone who wanted to speak with me about a writing group for people with Alzheimer's disease. And I immediately thought it was a bad idea.
Okay.
I didn't see it. I didn't see how it could work. I thought that it was going to be stressful for people, too dependent on a kind of facility for writing. I just didn't think it was a good idea. And I think I was kind of, I had blinders on, you know. I think I was really kind of limited in that respect. When I got on the phone with Don and we started to talk about it, he said writing is a form of memory. I asked him what his idea was, and he said, you know, writing is a form of memory, and perhaps it would be helpful for these people to have access to that form of memory as well. And that really struck me because I never thought about writing that way.
Right.
I never thought about different forms of memory, even.
The mysterious thing about writing, too, when I read this story about you, is that I think at all times in our life, sometimes you're able to write something down you didn't even know you knew. Right?
Yes. Right, right.
You didn't know you remembered. You didn't remember in that
mental
way until you wrote it.
Yeah, you think differently when you write.
Yeah.
You don't think the same way. Right? If I ask you to think about something just in your head, it's a different process and you use different parts of your brain.
Right.
So it really is different. It really is different. And so that just got me thinking about, well, you know, if there are different forms of memory and we're only using one of them in this way of working with these people, maybe that's just too limited, and maybe we ought to really open up our minds a little bit to this and what the possibilities are that are inherent in this. You know, in thinking back to that as well, I think it's really important for those of us in health-related professions to talk to people who are outside of the bubble, as it were.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, if you just talk to other psychologists and other doctors, and you know, you hear the same things all the time. And I think what is, I think, a lesson to be learned here from this experience is that an artist has a very different view of things, it took. I think it took an artist to point out this truth about what I was doing and what I could do for these people. A writer understood that in a way that I was not going to understand, certainly not initially, you know.
Something else that intrigued me that you've written about that and what you realized is that when you write something down, again, it's not just a mental activity. You actually leave a physical mark on the world. You kind of entrust it. You give it over.
Yeah.
beyond yourself.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, I mean, that was one of those things that until I was in the room, I don't know, sometimes, you know, something happens and you realize how right it is and you never could have thought of it.
Right.
But there you are doing it, right?
Right?
And yeah, I mean, you know, there we were in the room and they would write and they would finish writing and they would read and then they would, I asked them to give me what they wrote every time we met. And I did that because I knew they'd lose it, or I was afraid they'd lose it. Mm-hmm. I thought there was certainly a good chance they'd lose it. So there was a kind of a practical, you know, anxiety that was behind that, you know, technique, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But once that pattern got established, I saw that there was an enactment of something else going on there that was very profound. That was that they were turning their memories over to us. And these were people who might come back next week and not remember what they had written, right?
Right.
So it's a very, very therapeutic activity in that respect as well. And it was comforting to them, you know?
Yes.
No one objected, right?
Right.
You know, no one said, oh, no, I want to hold on to it.
Yeah.
You know, they turned it over.
And I think of... You wrote of your own grandmother, you said, as she neared the end of her life, my grandmother seemed to understand that if you can give something away, you don't lose it.
Right, right.
And that's something that people were able to enact, which is
yes.
actually taking a form of control, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's not a form of control that you can take if I sit you down and I say, well, I want to tell you something that I remember. You know, it's different, right? There's something about the verbal exchange. Mm-hmm. It just goes into the air, you know, like, where does it go? Where do the words go? I mean, you may say to me, oh, I'm never going to forget that, you know, right? That
right.
doesn't usually happen. But, but you know, verbal memory, it's different. It's kind of, it's invisible. Mm-hmm. It's not tangible. And there's something about writing that that is enormously helpful in this context. You know, you see it on the page, you know it's there, you can turn it over to someone else for safekeeping. You know, it lasts. The verbal stuff is much harder to recall. And again, remember, these are people who might forget a conversation and did, you know, on a regular basis, did forget conversations that we would have.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about something I experienced in the people with Alzheimer's I knew. Now, maybe this was at later stages because none of these people were all hospitalized. And,
right.
It's not just that, you know, so memory is a very complicated thing, right, in general and in Alzheimer's. So, yes, people lose short-term memory, but... I also found that on any given day, I might go in and sit with someone who I saw every week, and they would also inhabit memories, right? I mean, it was almost like a form of time travel. I mean, I would be sitting with someone, and often these were old memories, right? They were from childhood or early in their marriage, or but they were back there. You know, reliving. Mm-hmm. I want to say again, inhabiting memories, not just calling them up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Have you experienced that too? Is that something that happens later?
You know, in the later stages of the illness, people hallucinate.
Right, right.
And so they, so some of what you're describing can be attributable to that, not so much that they're imagining something, so it can still be within the context of their own.
No, I'm aware of that too. Yeah, that sometimes I would learn that wasn't reliable, that the story I heard wasn't
right.
Uh-huh.
Right. Yeah. And I think the vividness of the past relative to what's happening in the present becomes more and more powerful.
Right.
You know, the present just falls
because
away.
Because the present is so flimsy.
It's just, yeah, yeah. I mean, from moment to moment. And so, you know, you will encounter people who are entirely inhabiting their past in that way and speaking to you as if they are with you in their past. I've certainly had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
The present is not here. It can't. It slips through the fingers. And over time, the sense of self that is attached to that present also disappears. And so what you have is this kind of almost an archaic, right, representation of the self, of what was,
mm-hmm.
You know. Yeah.
Yeah, because you realize when you see someone going through this that all that memory holds. I mean, really, this is bigger than memory, isn't it? But so mm-hmm. so people lose their ability to present themselves. They lose their credentials. The mm-hmm. way we've presented and defined our identity and worth
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. in this culture, like what I do, who I am, mm-hmm. what I do.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
Or yeah. even people talking about, you know, all the things that get lost, like not being able to drive. I mean, how that affects yeah. people's identity.
Yeah. They really do, and they've talked with me, I've spoken with people about this. Part of what goes along with that is a profound sense of isolation from the world.
Mm-hmm.
They actually don't feel like they're in the same world as other people, you know. So, you know, they'll talk about the Alzheimer's world, you know, and missing the other world that they used to inhabit. I mean, you know, this kind of insight is fleeting, you know, it doesn't last for long. But mm-hmm. there are people who never have that much insight into what's happening to them. But certainly there are people who can articulate a sense, the kind of sense that you're describing, where that their identity has fallen away, where the place that they have in the world mm-hmm. is no longer there. You know, things are moving too quickly. Conversations move too
right,
quickly.
Right.
There is a loss of comprehension
mm-hmm.
Of, you know, the more subtle meanings of what people are saying. And so they start to kind of fall back a little bit, you know, and they're on the edge of conversations, on the edge of all kinds of things.
I also found gracious yeah. people who were embarrassed that they couldn't learn my name, you know? I mean, they knew that.
Yeah.
So even that was prevented them from, they felt, really connecting, really having.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We wore, we went through so many different, you know, and I'm still struggling with this, you know, name tags for people in groups. I mean, you know, people hate wearing name tags. At the same time, you know, it's very important to know people's names.
Yeah, yeah.
It fosters a connection that if you don't have that, something is really missing, you know. There's a kind of distance from each other that sets in when, you know, over and over again, even though you know these people, you can't say their name. But
mm-hmm.
It's a struggle. It's a real struggle. You know, they sort of don't want to be tagged.
Yeah.
But
right.
at the same time, it's very hard to remember, you know.
And, you know, conversely, it was so, I felt that it was so powerful for me because by the same token, these people I was meeting for the first time, becoming friends with, didn't care about my credentials, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my presentation, the way I normally present myself or define myself, all those footholds of the world also were mm-hmm. completely meaningless for them in mm-hmm. my interaction with them. And there was something so challenging in the best way about, because what was really mm-hmm. going to matter is if I was present,
mm-hmm.
if
mm-hmm.
I listened, if I was respectful, if I was caring.
Yeah.
These things that actually really do matter in life more than our credentials, but we're not
Absolutely.
Pushed to that place very often, especially not with strangers.
Yeah, Yeah, absolutely. There is that. There is absolutely that kind of stripping away of the kind of the veneer, the top layer, and a very, very basic, very, very basic level of understanding that you have to operate on. And it becomes more and more so, certainly with people who are in a hospital setting like the one you're describing. It's it's everything. Your tone of voice, the way you carry yourself. You know, often there really isn't much verbally that you can do that's comprehended, or there isn't much that you can comprehend about what they're saying to you. So how do you connect? You know, how do you connect? It's a very basic exercise at that point, you know, the expression on your face.
Yes.
It's, you know, it is a little bit like the way you communicate with a baby, right?
You sent along some of the writings, some of the things people had written in your group, and, you know, they're just very striking. I mean, one woman describing how she tried to mask this. I suppose the early stages, and how very uncomfortable and painful it had become to be in the world, I think, as you say. I don't think that's phrase. And then her relief at finding this group. And then the man named Saul, who said, you know, having been a leader most of my life, I now find myself extremely dependent on others.
Yeah.
Which in this culture especially is a heartbreaking sentence.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's he was a leader in the group.
Was he?
He was. Yeah, he was a leader in the group. He was one of those people who he was the last one to stop driving.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, Saul had a car, and he would drive to the sessions, so you know, he continued in that way. He had that spirit, absolutely. But he also was very, very mindful of how dependent he was on his wife and on other people to continue living his life the way he wanted to live, you know. Yeah. Yeah, but they were so happy, and they are so happy to find one another. And again, you know, that's the only way to break through the isolation. It's you know, that sense of commonality is very, very powerful. I can't give it to them, you know, and their family members can't give it to them. It's only in finding other people who you recognize, you know, and who recognize you. That's so important, because isolation is ultimately the destination that this illness brings them to, right? It's more and more and more isolation. So whenever it's possible to be in a group, and not just any group, because there are lots of ways in which people with dementia congregate, but they're not conscious, you know what I mean? Like, you know, you can be still alone in a group.
Right.
The thing about the writing group and the thing about the support groups is that they're there, and we are talking about why they are there and who they are there, you know? That's by definition what we're doing. We're meeting as a kind of a group of people with something in common. They need that. They really need that.
I want to ask you, you know, we invited listeners a couple of months ago to write to us if they had an experience with this illness. I don't think we heard from anybody who has Alzheimer's, but from people who love someone who has Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And this is something I wondered about also when I was knowing people with Alzheimer's. And I just want to ask you, I think that some people, but certainly not all, by the later stages, believe that the core of this person they love, or their, you know, who is a part of their family, that what is left is the core of this person. And there are some people who say, you know, this the gentleness, the kindness, the joy that was always at the heart of my mother is now there, and it's a beautiful thing, even as it's hard. Mm. But that's not the story everyone tells. And
no.
And there's also this hard edge to this, the paranoia, the violent behavior, the loss of boundaries that comes at different mm-hmm. stages in the disease. I just want to ask you, from the experiences you've had, how do you think about that? What mm-hmm. what is left after so much is unlearned?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really tough one, you know, because it's hard to. It is.
You don't want to romanticize it either, right? I mean, I love hearing these stories when people say this is the essence of kindness, but I don't. I think it's more complicated than that.
It is. It is. It is more complicated, and there are people whose experience with their family members in this illness is just full of despair mm-hmm. and pain, mm-hmm. and of watching someone in a very uncomfortable place, and someone who makes them very uncomfortable. So, you know, that happens. That happens. I think that the history of the relationship is important here.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the story goes on in some form or another. Is what my observation is. Mm-hmm. I've seldom encountered circumstances where there's an absolute discontinuity. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, so, mm-hmm. you know, the gentle person turns into a violent, paranoid person. And I think it's also important to say that that's not a common outcome for people with Alzheimer's. It does happen. Mm-hmm. Most often that happens when people with Alzheimer's are confused, when they are uncomfortable, when they mm-hmm. are in pain. Mm-hmm. There are ways of treating that. It's not part and parcel, something that goes along with the disease. I think it's important to acknowledge that. But I think that, you know, to the extent that you can make some sense of it, it's within the context of some relationship
of what has come before,
preceded that stage. Mm-hmm. But it's hard. It's hard because there are times when you look and you just don't see. You can't find anything. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. you just can't find it. And you don't, so where is the person? And then there are times when, you know, you or I could go and look and we would see nothing, and the family member is seeing something, or the caregiver, the paid caregiver is there and seeing something and relating to a part of this person inside there, you know, mm-hmm. that is still alive and still somehow sending out a dispatch that they hear, you know,
right.
And it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary when you see that. But a lot gets lost. I had a woman recently describe it to me as invasion of the body snatchers.
Yeah,
she said, you know, it's like
she was.
It looks like him, but it's not him. He's not in there. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody took him out of there. That's her experience with her husband now. Mm-hmm. Very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with Gisela Webb? She's actually a professor of religious studies who wrote an essay that's quite beautiful about her mother's struggle with Alzheimer's and how she drew on different texts from the Tibetan Book of the Dead to Al-Ghazali's to Muslim texts and St. Augustine's Confessions. And she called this the great unlearning. But she was very, it felt very important for her to observe what was left. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, it's easy to put our finger as we are on memories go, and lots of features of identity go. But she felt I just want to know what you think about this, that intuition, that feelings are still there, emotion is still there, even when there are no words to put around it, that intuition is there. She felt that humor is something that stayed with her mother. Just wonder how you think about what is left, what is enduring.
I think a lot of those basic things are still there. And so, you know, when you talk about feeling, I mean, feeling is there. And it is, and, you know, we express feelings nonverbally.
Yes.
So, I've walked up to people who've just looked at me and started crying. On an Alzheimer's unit. And, well, what are they crying about? I don't know. I don't know what they're crying about, but I know that they're sad. I know that they're crying about something. The same thing with laughter. Absolutely. It's there. I would go even a little bit farther than that. There are flashes. There are moments that I've had where there's wisdom. That is apparent, it hits you like a ton of bricks, this is an element that I think has a kind of spiritual component in my experience anyway with people like this.
Can you give me an example?
Well, my favorite is. I was working with a woman who actually first came to see me. She brought her sister to see me. Her name was Anne, and she brought her sister to see me, and she wanted actually her sister to join one of the writing groups, and her sister wasn't right for the writing group, and so I saw her, and they left, and about 2 years later, she came back, and she had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and so I started to work with her, and she joined one of my support groups, and she was in the group for a long time. And then it just became impossible for her to participate. The conversation was moving too fast. She just didn't have the language. She couldn't string together more than a sentence or two, and it just wasn't working. And so she had to leave the group. And her husband, who was just extraordinarily devoted to her, really wanted her to maintain her connection with me and asked if I would see her. And I have to say, I had misgivings about that. I for her to come to my office and just meet with me there when her ability to talk was so limited, but I'd known her a long time, and there was a kind of a connection that we had that I thought might make it possible. And so she came and she saw me in my office. She would come once a week. We didn't meet for a full kind of psychotherapy session time. That was too much time. And basically I spent time with her trying to connect, and we talked. I made use of what I knew about her. It was very helpful that I had known her before, and she would bring photo albums in. She would do a kind of little tchotchka tour of my office, when it wasn't really possible to talk about things. She would kind of walk around and we would look at objects, and she was very taken by the birds outside the window. I mean, that was the kind of time that we spent together. And then even that became difficult. She was one of those people who started to kind of retreat into almost a mask-like blankness. It was harder and harder to access her, and you'd ask her a question and you'd see a kind of flash of recognition on her face, like she understood what you were saying and she was about to answer, and you'd hear her breathe in, even, the words were going to come out, and then it would just kind of freeze, and this would just happen over and over again. It was very, very hard to be with her. And so we were reaching the end of that time, and I was talking to her husband, telling him that I just didn't think that it was, a really fruitful way for for her to spend her time and so on. And so it was around that time, and I was going on vacation, and she loved the beach, and I love the beach, and this was something that we used to connect about as well. And I was going to the beach. And I said to her, as I was leaving, I said, Anne, I'm going to the beach. I'm going to be away for a while. And she smiled, and there was her face kind of lit up. And I said, you love the beach, don't you? And she said, yes. And I said, what do you love about the beach? And as I said that, I actually kind of almost stopped myself because I had been talking too much, you know, with her. Right. It was just too much language, you know, right. And I was realizing that it just wasn't going to work. But whatever, the question came out, you know, what do you love about the beach? And she kind of drifted away as she did, and she got very quiet. And again, I waited, and I thought, well, you know, she can't really answer that question. And she turned to me and she said, there's some kind of music that lives there. And I thought, oh, God, that's the best answer. That was just a wonderful answer. And, you know, not a summer has gone by that I haven't thought of that at some moment, at some beach. So to me, that's like a prayer. You know, where does it come from? You know, in the A.J. Heschel sense of prayer, right? This sense of, you know, like a sense of wonder, the sense of that place between knowing and not knowing, the mystery of things. You know, so that's in there too, yeah. You never know when it's gonna kind of come out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, speaking of prayer and ritual, I mean, I do remember how striking it was, and I've since read other accounts of this when I was working on the Alzheimer's floor, how people who could not string a sentence together, I mean, who maybe didn't even ever talk, the chaplain would come in and they would say the Lord's Prayer, or they, right?
Uh-huh.
Or they would sing a hymn.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
I don't know, the 23rd Psalm. And the words came out perfectly. There was something so mysterious about that.
Yes.
That these things seemed to be rooted so deep down, and they were indestructible when nothing else seemed to be out of bounds. I mean, have you experienced that, and how do you explain that?
Sure. Well, the scientific term, they're well-learned, right? You know, that's how people describe that. It's you know, that you've learned something so well, you've repeated it so many times, it's almost like muscle memory, right?
It
doesn't require this kind of conscious effort to repeat. And so there it is. But I still think it's mysterious whether you explain it that way or not. There is something that is mysterious about that. And it highlights the ways in which memory is always a creative process. To me, that's the other thing that I take away from that. So that we're always constructing it. That is, in fact, you know, I mean, people, you know, the internal experience is one in which we kind of dip into the memory bank and, you know, pull out the memory in its full form, right? But the more we learn about this, the more we realize that, in fact, it's scattered. It doesn't exist in one place. It gets pulled together, right?
Right.
It gets recreated. That's why we never remember anything exactly the same way. And so maybe, for people like that as well, there is that flash of a kind of creative process that's still, you know, the underlying neurological equipment is still intact enough to make it possible every so often, and it gets through, you know, something like that gets through.
And how it is bound up also with emotions, with joy and comfort. I mean, you can see people are also radiant in these moments sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. It's there. That's there, and you know, it's a blessing that it's there. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is that it sometimes it's the thing that enables family members to go on, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it sort of relieves the despair. You know, like he said, you know, he said this to me today. You know, someone will come in, a caregiver will come in and say, oh, you'll never believe what he said to me today. You know, he's been quiet. He hasn't said a thing for, you know, whatever, a week or two. He's hadn't been. And then he said this thing, you know, he looked at me and he touched my hand and he said, I'm really glad you're here, or something like that, you know, mm-hmm. something simple. Mm-hmm. And it's like manna from heaven, you know. It's it's important. Mm-hmm. It's important to those people. That's what keeps them going.
Are there other mysterious things like that, or I don't know, something else that's striking to
you? Yeah. Another one that I also remember that stays with me is I was working with a woman whose husband was in a nursing home, and there's that period of time when people with Alzheimer's begin to not recognize their family members, and it's wrenching and it's painful and it's awful. Mm-hmm. It's just awful. And she was in that period of time, and so it would happen every so often, you know. And the first time it happened, she came back to me in kind of a panic, she was distraught and said she didn't want to live anymore, and mm-hmm. if he wasn't going to recognize her, and what started to happen was that she would go and see him, and the first thing she would say was, "Do you remember who I am? Do you remember who I am? Do you remember who I am?" You know, and sometimes he would, you know, and because it kind of waxes and wanes when that starts to happen. It seldom just falls away all at once. It's, you know, it'll happen once and then not again for a month or two or whatever, and then it'll come back and it'll seem to persist for a little bit longer, and then eventually it does, you know, there is no recognition. But she was doing this thing, and I was trying to convince her and trying to help her to kind of back off of that.
Right.
That, you know, and I was suggesting to her that there are other ways that she could see that he recognizes her. And there are, in fact, you know, mm-hmm. even when someone can't answer that question, you can see on their face, you can see in their body language, there are lots of ways that you can tell. But it was no use. She was just focused on this thing. And he got to a certain point where he couldn't answer the question. And one day she went in and she asked him, and he looked at her and he said, "I don't know who you are, but I love you." And I thought, you know, he thought of the right answer.
He did. I mean, he understood what she needed to hear.
He totally understood. And again, you know, that was very wise. That was very wise. And you know, on another level, I thought a lot about it. And I thought, you know, what endures, you know? What endures, you know? Mm-hmm. Does the name endure? Does the recognition endure? To me, that's a statement about, you know, that love is enduring, actually, mm-hmm. right? That you can hold on to that sometimes even after you've lost all the other things, you know. So that one has stayed with me. I mean, some of these things just feel to me like, principles for living a good life, you know, right?
Right. I would ask you that something you wrote, I think this is you making sense of what you learned, just, you know, continuing what I think you were just saying. You said someone has said to you, I feel like a picture that is fading. And you note that's true for all of us. And you wrote, watching the group members in their struggle to remember, write, and read their work is a moving experience on many levels. One of these is surely our awareness that the picture is fading along with the sparks of recognition. This awareness lends a poignancy and triumph to the work with which one can identify. We all know what fading is like, and we all know that our fate is not so different from theirs. The triumph is temporary. It is of this moment, but it's the triumph of life over death.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when we first heard, when we first listened to the work that people were producing in the writing group, I was really kind of astonished by how profound it seemed. And I sort of couldn't believe it. Like, I thought, well, what is this? I mean, what, you know, are they great writers? Would these people have a particular talent for writing? I mean, what is actually going on here, you know? In the end, I think it's that. It's that they were making a statement about who they are, and the moment that they were in was such that it has this kind of resonance that feels familiar to all of us on some deep level, which is that we don't have an unlimited amount of time, and we're going to run out of it. We're going to run out of it. And when you watch these people, you see people who are running out of time. Mm-hmm. And they don't... And so there's almost something heroic, you know? Like, I'm going to tell you who I am before it's too late. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to tell you this story about, you know, picking lilacs from a tree with my mother. You know, I'm going to... Whatever it is, you know, a simple story like that somehow has this kind of... It's elevated. You know, it's elevated by the circumstance. I think Don, in his book...
Don DeLillo.
Yeah, yeah. He writes about the group, and he refers to it as a final authority. They summon the force of final authority. No one knew what they knew here in the last clear minute before it all closed down. He was writing in this book that he wrote called Falling Man about a group not unlike the group that we ran, a writing group for people in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. But I think that that's what gets conveyed through the writing. It's remarkable how it reads when you encounter it, and I think we're not that different from them.
There's that one line from one of the people in your writers group. I can remember picking a fig from a tree in Athens. My lover watches me with delight.
Yeah.
That's two sentences. It tells a story that paints such a vivid picture.
Yes, yes. And you have the page in front of you, right?
I typed that down. I don't have the page in front of me.
Okay, because the page, you know, you see the effort there also in that page.
I mean, she crossed it out and started over again. Yes.
And she can't quite get the spelling right. And the letters are backwards, and and when she read that, it was like, you know, you just wanted to stand up and applaud.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, because it was so lovely, and
And you alluded to this a little while ago, but I do want to mention it. Something that really formed me and made me think about what a kind of linear verbal idea we have of memory and communication. And certainly I'm completely word oriented. There is body memory that I think we're learning more about in the 21st century even than we knew a couple years ago. How eye contact and touch and just presence and indulging simple pleasures, like, you know, there was one woman who I could wheel her outside to sit in the flowers. And she would be so sad and withdrawn when I arrived, sitting in that common room. And she would come to life. And, you know, I could just imagine what stories were behind that. But I mean, I think that was also about body memory. I'm imagining this woman who wrote about picking the fig from a tree in Athens, if you could somehow take her to that place in Athens, even after she... long after she could write those sentences, she would feel that story. I think she did.
I think she did feel that story when she wrote that, and I think she felt that story when she shared it with us. Mm-hmm. She was delighted to share that with us, I think that it absolutely was processed on a lot of different levels. It's still with us. Mm-hmm. She's gone. She's been gone for a while, you know? And here we are talking about her lover and that fig tree.
And that delight.
And I just, you know, for me, that there's a deep sense of satisfaction in that and comfort in that. Mm-hmm. And it's something else that I've learned from this group. You really can give memories to other people, and they last. You can't always know which ones are going to last, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. But there's something about that that's a comfort, even as we know that, you know, all the other stuff is true as well about our limited time and what we can accomplish and what we can't accomplish and all of it. But if you give it away and if you give voice to it, you never know what's going to happen to it. It can go on. And then other people take it and have their own experiences.
And now we're talking about it on the radio.
And here we are. Yeah.
And okay, so I feel like we have like 25 minutes left, and I want to talk about what this does to you, and we've been indulging in that a bit. But I feel like I need to say that. Mm-hmm. So I would work in the Alzheimer's floor, and I would just come home beaming, you know, in this strange way. And I would say mm-hmm. it's paradoxical because there's so much sadness and heartbreak there, and my heart is broken every time. Mm-hmm. And yet it's a transformative experience. It connects me with humanity in some way. And then mm-hmm. I feel like I have to say, and I'm sure you'd want me to say this, is that for family members who are living through this, and when it goes on for years and years, and there are all these different stages, and it's hard, right?
I was reading something
that a caregiver said. I think this was in an article in the New York Times, you know, something like at some point there can be these there's something transcendent about it, but there's also just the pain in the neck of it, that it's unbearable. And that's what a lot of people are living through.
Yes. It is. It's deadening. It's mm-hmm. deadening. Mm-hmm. You're right. There's a kind of different side of the coin here when you talk about the families.
Yeah.
We've been, you know, dwelling on one piece of this. I have great compassion for people who have to live with that. Mm. And I really see them as also having the illness in a way. Mm. I mean, and that's what I tell them. They're in danger. I see them as being in danger. It's a dangerous occupation, being the caregiver for somebody with Alzheimer's disease, being a family caregiver. Yeah. Very different than what you and I are talking about.
Yeah.
Very different.
Yeah. I want to ask you this. If you found out today that you or your spouse were in the early stages of Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. what would be your reaction?
Hmm. Well, I'd be very sad. I'd be very sad, I think, probably first. I'd be very sad. I'd be very sad for a long time, probably. I'd feel a sense of grief and mourning for what I knew that I was going to lose. I think that's where I'd be at the outset of it.
Would it be very different from how you would have reacted if you hadn't done all this work?
Yeah, I don't think I'm as scared of it, actually, as I used to be. I'm not scared of it, I don't think. Now, I think that before I worked with people with Alzheimer's and before I was immersed in it in this way, I would have been much more frightened.
And why are you not as scared?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question.
See, I haven't done as much as you have, but I felt exactly the same way after I had spent that year and a half with people with Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And one of the things I thought I would do is not let anybody give me antipsychotic medication because I felt like medicating was worse. But I know that that's also not the whole story. But you do hear about how this is the disease that people in the United States are more scared of than anything else. This is what no one wants to happen to them.
Yeah.
But you don't feel that way having done this work.
No. No, I find other things much scarier. You know, pain, you know, I mean, we could go down the list. I'm sure we could think of all kinds of things that, you know, terrify us and, you know, the things that happen to people. But no, I don't. It's tragic.
Mm-hmm.
So the grief is, it would be hard to take. The grief would be hard to take. I'm not afraid. It slips away, you know. It slips away, and I guess the other thing that you learn is that for the people who go through it, they're not generally aware of it on this level. They lose along with, you know, the kind of basic things, the elements of memory and cognitive functioning that they lose. They also lose that higher sense of insight into what's going on, what the bigger picture is.
The analytical
abilities. You know, I have this, I had this experience of doing a workshop and there were people with Alzheimer's in the room and there were about 20 people in the room and we were kind of going around in a circle and people in the with early Alzheimer's were talking about, you know, their lives and how they, what they do, kind of give their lives meaning and, you know, find stimulating things to do and so on. And this man started talking about his experience as somebody with early Alzheimer's. And he was painting a very kind of benign picture of it all. He said, well, you know, it's difficult not to be able to remember, and I get up and I can do this and I can do that. And I, you know, and basically he was just saying he's fine, he's okay. And over his shoulder, sitting behind him, was his wife.
Right.
And she was crying.
Oh.
She was crying. And I knew, you know, he's kind of on this superficial level of understanding of just how much he's lost, how much she has lost, you know. But there he was, you know. He wasn't uncomfortable. He really wasn't, right? I think we project our, you know, we project our feelings onto them and we assume that they are, you know, are suffering some, you know, right? Terrible thing. But in fact, you know, that's not necessarily the experience of it, you know.
Well, let me ask you this. If you found out that you had Alzheimer's or your spouse had Alzheimer's, I mean, what would you do if yes, you would grieve, you would be sad, but knowing what you know, having seen what you've seen, what would you want to do to make this as, I don't know what the word is, meaningful? No, but what would feel important to you as a reaction?
I really think that I would want to spend time remembering whatever I could about my life and about the things that I've done and the things that were important to me. And finding some organized way, some regular way to convey that to the people who are important to me. I just think that, you know, as I said in the chapter that I wrote about this, about the writing group, I'd want to be surrounded by acts of remembering as much as possible. There's a kind of, I do think that one of the really difficult things that people with Alzheimer's experience is this tyranny of having to remember everything that they subject themselves to, and that as soon as they forget something, it's, it's a bad sign, and so on. And of course, the truth is, we're all forgetting things all the time. You know, they're not the only ones forgetting things, right? But as soon as you've got a diagnosis, the minute you forget something, you feel like the Grim Reaper has, descended and lopped off something from, right? So it's important to kind of have some antidote to that, to have an opportunity where you're a person who remembers something, not just a person who's forgetting all the time. Okay. And I guess that's what I would try to, do. And be in a group.
Yeah. You'd probably get into a writer's group, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So we've been talking a lot about memory, and I was reading, there was just an article, a New York Times article from 2001 that referred in shorthand to Alzheimer's as a disease of thinking. And I thought, boy, that's so inadequate. But it made me wonder, what I'd like to ask you is, this is kind of a huge philosophical question, but how do you think differently about the distinctions between or overlap between memory, thought, consciousness? I mean, is consciousness the same as memory? Some people call this a demise of consciousness. And maybe in this, I would also ask you how you when we first began to speak, you talked about memory and Jewish tradition and your religious sensibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you understand these things differently because of your experience with Alzheimer's?
Mm-hmm. I guess, I almost hesitate to say this because I feel like it sounds corny, but I guess I have to start here because that's the first thing that comes to mind. I mean, when you've seen the unraveling of this consciousness that we have, right, and that is definitely a word that I would use, when you've seen the unraveling from beginning to end, right, you can't help but recognize what a miracle it is, this mind that we have, this conversation that you and I are having. The fact that I'll leave here and kind of put myself out there into the world and think about 100 other things. it's really miraculous. Even the most ordinary brain is miraculous. Mm. And so I have come away certainly with a renewed appreciation of that. And I guess, that does sound a little bit like, the near-death experience, and now I really appreciate life. Mm. But I certainly have that. But on the other side of the coin, I realize how ungrateful we are. We don't notice it really. I mean, I don't want to generalize too much, but I think we tend not to notice it unless it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then we get all, bent out of shape. Oh, I can't remember this or I can't remember that. But from moment to moment, it's a miracle. Hmm. It's really a miracle that all of this works and that it works in the way that it does and that it has the richness that it does, that it takes in so much, and that our internal lives and the lives that we can build as a result of what's inside are so rich, So I absolutely have been touched in that way. I also think about it's also influenced the way I think about God. Mm. You know, we're taught that we're created in the image of God. Mm. So, and I was taught that, and I accepted that. And so, what does that mean? When you see things like this, you know, where I've kind of landed with all of that is that if it's true that we are created in God's image, then God has Alzheimer's as well.
Why do you say right? That's
part of it. It's not just the miraculous stuff. It's not just it's all of it. Mm-hmm. It's not just the awe-inspiring, beautiful things. It's the brokenness. Mm-hmm. It's the cruelty of this. All of it. The way I see it, it has to be, it can't just be one or the other. It has to be all of it, if that's true. Mm-hmm. That's okay. That's okay with me. And I guess it kind of also has reinforced my own sense that what you do with that is, and that our task is to just try and repair as much as we can. Mm. That's certainly part of my tradition, and it's a part of my tradition that speaks to me, so that, you know, the world is broken and people get broken too, right. In the course of their lives. That's the way the world is. It's not because somebody made it that way or someone's being punished or anything like that. It's part of what's been bequeathed to us along with everything else, you know. So those are some of the ways in which those ideas intersect, you know, with Alzheimer's for me.
There's all that language in the Hebrew Bible about God remembering, right? God remembering. Does that have different connotations for you now? Which also means that God forgot, doesn't it?
Absolutely. That's what I mean. Uh-huh. I mean, you can't remember. Mm-hmm. You can't only remember. Mm-hmm. If you're remembering, then there's the absence of remembering also, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I think there's probably a whole theology embedded in that. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, that bad things happen when God forgets us, or when we forget God or something. But I it is very striking to me how much there is about memory, certainly in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the pivot point for so many things, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's makes sense. It's a very fundamental human characteristic.
So you've written, for people in the early stages of the illness who are experiencing the impairments but still entirely cognizant of the dissolution that lays ahead, the challenge is to construct a life in the shadow of the advancing darkness to answer the question, what is the point? And I wanted to ask you how you answer that question differently because of this work you've done with Alzheimer's, these people you've known.
It's not to give up is another piece of it, you know. I think that I am inspired by the courage that leads people to continue to connect to kind of show up, you know, in this group situation where they're going to write things down when they've never written anything on a piece of paper before in quite that way, or where they're going to meet new people. I think that that's inspiring. Not giving up is high on my list there. You know, that's part of the point. Always looking for that spark, you know, in that darkness, because it gets pretty dark. Mm-hmm. It does get pretty dark in there. Mm-hmm. I think that you have to have the right people around you. It's hard to see your way to anything else, you know. And I've had that experience. I'm sure you've had that experience as well. If you've been on, on those units. I mean, you don't always. I can say for myself. I don't. Sometimes I'm not equal to it, you know. Mm-hmm. So I get there. I'll be there, and I just feel engulfed by the. By the despair,
right.
by the darkness of it, by the, you know, the deadness,
the raw sadness.
I just want to flee. I just want to run as far away as I possibly can run. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to do that sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that's true for caregivers as well.
It is absolutely true for caregivers. I think that caregivers really, the line between the person with Alzheimer's and the person who is caring for them can become blurred to such a degree that the caregiver's future becomes the same future as the person with Alzheimer's. They really do begin to feel as if they too are dying. They really do begin to feel as if they are losing their minds. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had that experience as well. There's something about talking with someone whose grip on the moment is loose that can induce in you a kind of confusional state. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, you ask a question, then there's a long pause, then there's an answer. The answer is not quite the answer to the question that you asked. It's a different kind of answer. Mm-hmm. The language is a little bit jumbled. You're trying to follow it. Then they stop. And then I can't tell you how many times I've had the experience where I thought, what was the question that I asked? Mm-hmm. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. You know, right? That's what that is. It's people who are impaired in that way, they have to have some way of conveying their experience to you. They can't really tell you what they're going through. Mm-hmm. And so they affect you in that way. They give you a sense when you're with them of what it's like. And I think that's what happens. But if you're a family member and this is going on day in and day out, right? It's one thing to be a psychologist or doctor, and
you're
in and you're out.
Right.
But if you're a family member and that's going on, just imagine what kind of impact it has on your sense of reality, on your sense of who you are and what the world is like. And so it's the line can become the line can really become blurred, and that's why it is dangerous. I think for caregivers, they really need outside sources of support.
Hmm. Yeah, there's something in this for another conversation, isn't there, about who we are for each other and in some very distorted and difficult way, how we are all always intertwined and have this need.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think we have to finish. Unfortunately, this has been a great conversation. I really enjoyed it and appreciate it.
Yeah, me too.
And it's a conversation I've wanted to have for a long time. So, we will we'll let you know what's happening with this and when, and may have some questions, which we can send by email or give you a call. Is that all right? Let me ask you this. You say your name Dienstag, is that right? Rather than Dienstag?
Yes.
You don't say the German way? Okay.
No.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Krista. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Paul.